from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. On November 5th, San Francisco voters will decide whether to approve a range of initiatives, including a $600 million affordable housing bond, a plan to levy a tax on Uber and Lyft riders, and a measure that would reauthorize the sale of e-cigarettes and vaping products in the city. Voters will also choose a new district attorney and decide whether to re-elect Mayor London Breed. We'll review the November ballot and take your questions on the election and San Francisco politics. It's all coming up next after this news. Welcome to this morning's forum. I'm Michael Krasny. San Francisco voters head to the polls in less than 2 weeks to weigh in on local initiatives addressing affordable housing, a tax on Uber and Lyft rides, and e-cigarettes. And they'll also cast votes for mayor and district attorney. And in this segment, we're going to review the ballot, and we want to hear from you. How will you vote and why? You can give us a call right now at our toll-free number. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Let me repeat the number, 866-733-6786. And this, of course, is part of our ongoing election coverage. Joining us here in studio is Marisa Lagos, politics correspondent with KQED and co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown Show. Good morning, Marisa.
Morning, Michael.
I'm breaking down here, apparently.
It's okay. It's been a week already, and it's Wednesday.
Syllables are in the wrong place, yeah. Dominic Fracasso is also with us in studio. He's a staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle and covers politics. Good morning, Dominic.
Good morning.
And we'll also say good morning to Eric Algalar, who is a reporter for KQED News. And good morning, Erica.
Good morning.
Good to have all of you aboard here. And, Eric, I'm going to begin with you. Housing is clearly on people's minds. And let's talk first about Proposition A, which is about $600 million for affordable housing. And it's a bond, and it needs two-thirds to pass, which bonds do. This is the biggest, really, in San Francisco history. It's about double for the last one a couple of years ago.
That's right. The 2015 bond was $310 million. And this one, you know, is basically almost doubled that, or a little bit more than that. But this bond will, as the supporters behind it say, will fund approximately 2,800 units of affordable housing in about 5 years. And it's broken down by income levels. So you get $150 million for repairing public housing and like $220 million for low-income housing. And that's to buy, rehab, and build new housing.
And senior housing as well. Yeah.
That's right. That's right. This one has about, let me think, $150 million for senior housing, and that's also to buy and build that. And that's just to address, you know, the housing crunch that we see here in the San Francisco Bay Area.
Terrible housing crunch, and the voters will decide, but they're talking about estimates of about 250,000 to 300,000 per unit, and with construction costs going up probably as we're speaking here, that may be a low estimate.
Yeah, that is. I think actually the mayor's office of housing and community development estimates that it takes about $700,000 to build an affordable housing unit. And it takes a period of almost 5 years to build a housing development project from acquiring the land to getting through all the approval process and construction and getting people inside those units. So it's housing, you know, building housing in general is expensive. Building affordable housing is expensive, too.
Well, this is one of the six propositions that will be on the ballot, on the November ballot. We'll talk about the others, but let's stay with housing just for the moment because we're talking about
That's
A,
right.
But also E is about affordable housing as well, opening it up somewhat on public lands. And this means, at least according to what the Hoopla is saying, teachers and low-wage workers can actually stop fleeing from San Francisco.
Yeah, Proposition E is a change to the city's planning code. It's a rezoning type of a proposition. What it would allow is housing projects that are 100% affordable or educator housing to be allowed and built on publicly owned land. And that would also relax the zoning requirements. So we're talking about height limits and spacing, and then expedite those process, the approval process for some of those things. Now, this is a this is an interesting proposition because not only will it serve educators and educators of all types, you know, we're not just talking about teachers, but paraeducators or the staff at the school district and also City College. But the interesting thing about this is if you find a pieces of land that connect together that are about 10,000 square feet or more, and the city then finds a way to acquire that land, this proposition could be useful for affordable housing, not just for educators, but affordable housing of all types around the city.
I think of that measure as not so much as inducing.
This is Dominic Vercosa. Go ahead, Dominic.
Thanks. Not so much as inducing the creation of housing, but lowering barriers to getting it built in the first place. There's no money attached to this one, right? But it's saying there are these parcels that you described, 10,000 square feet, that currently you can't build any housing on at all, let alone affordable housing or anything else. But we're going to say, okay, now at least you have the possibility of doing it. But all of the barriers that you described, the hundreds of thousands of dollars per unit, the 5-year timeline, I mean, all of that, those barriers still exist, but at least it's legal to build there now. That's kind of, the thought behind this measure.
And let me ask you to move forward here on some of the other bond measures, because, as I said, we've got six. Which are the most important as you see it?
Well, just one bond measure, six ballot measures in total.
Six ballot measures, excuse me.
That's a great question. I mean, up until a couple of weeks ago, Proposition C, the ballot measure sort of created and funded by Juul, the e-cigarette maker, was really the talk of the town. Up until late September, they decided they're pulling all their funding for the measure and just kind of letting it twist in the wind and letting the opposition kind of run rampant in terms of advertising and just coverage. But in terms of importance, honestly, I'm gonna go controversial here, and I'm gonna say it's Proposition A. I think funding affordable housing in San Francisco is quietly it's a complicated issue. It's not always fun to talk about, and I know people's eyes glaze over pretty easily. But I mean, we're talking about an affordability crisis. We're talking about people and educators as well, people of all stripes, the working class people who are being forced to flee San Francisco, who are on the precipice of homelessness sometimes, and this is housing. Everybody says the biggest barrier to building affordable housing is money, and this is potentially it. So I think voters are going to decide if they want the city to effectively spend money on this.
And I would agree with you. This is that's why I started with it. But we have some other ballot measures which really need to be sort of explained to the public here. Sure. If they're not aware of them, if they haven't read about them, and that probably will have a good deal of impact. We're talking about tax on Uber and Lyft, for example, which is Proposition D, which could bring in about $32 million. And you mentioned about Juul sort of backing out of everything. It was surprising that both Lyft and Uber have agreed not to oppose this, largely, I guess, because of the efforts of Aaron Peskin.
That's correct. I mean, he and his staff spent a long time with the companies, getting them to the table and getting them to essentially not fight this proposal. So this is a tax on every Uber and Lyft ride between 1.5 and 3.25%. Again, each ride. The thing that I find interesting is whether and how that gets passed on to the drivers, to the actual sort of workforce behind Uber and Lyft. But that's a story to talk about after it passes. But, you know, it's going to be, you know, less of a tax if you ride in a pool with multiple people, more of a tax if you have a single ride. The whole idea, and Aaron Peskin has been explicit about this, is to reduce the crippling congestion on San Francisco streets. I mean, this is $32 million. This is chump change to these companies. But the hope is that by, you know, having a tax, you can be seen as, you know, quote unquote, tough on tech a little bit. You can force them to cough up the money. They're using city infrastructure, roads and everything like that. And, you know, this $32 million a year is slated to be spent on various transit improvements, which San Francisco needs very desperately.
Desperately indeed. What about Proposition F? Let me get you on that, Dominic, because this is all about dark money and super PACs.
That's right. The Sunlight on Dark Money Initiative, Proposition F. So this has been kind of a quiet one, a measure that seeks to sort of crack open the black box behind political spending. Isn't usually going to raise a ton of money and do a lot of advertising. That's just sort of the nature of that beast. But what Proposition F seeks to do is sort of unpack some of the sort of nesting dolls, which inside of which money is very easily hidden in political campaigns. The last time we elected a mayor last spring, it was not that long ago.
God, yeah. It seems so long ago, but
we're talking about millions of dollars spent, I think around $7 to $8 million in that one race alone. So in mirroring the national trend, we've got gobs of money flowing into local races. And this would seek to say, OK, look, if you are going to fund a political advertisement, we want to know who your top three donors owners are. So it's not going to be enough in most instances to say, ah, this measure or this advertisement was brought to you by the, you know, San Franciscans for Truth and Justice. So what does that mean? That doesn't mean anything. You could hide anything and anyone behind a front like that. So you're going to have to disclose who your top donors are. Also interesting, and again, getting back to land use, getting back to housing in many cases, it's also going to require that anybody who has business before land use business before the city, they're going to be restricted if this measure passes from making political contributions within 12 months of any given campaign. So it's going to say, look, land use is so politically important in this city. If you have business before the city, we're not going to allow you to make a political contribution while your issue is pending before city officials.
Just before we go to Marisa, and I want to talk to her about that mayor's race as well as the DA race, two big races going on in San Francisco. We've covered, at least in a cursory way here, but nevertheless, I think an important way, five of those ballot measures. There's one we haven't even talked about, and it's one that's getting very little attention Norman Yee put on, and that has to do essentially with kind of shifting names around, doesn't it, Morgan?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. Proposition B. It's not really getting a lot of attention. It's not terribly sexy to talk about, but Norman Yee believes it's important. He's the president of the Board of Supervisors, and he has made seniors and senior housing and senior health care a big sort of platform for him. It's very important to him, you know, personally and politically. So what this is, it has to go before voters because it's technically a change of the city charter. So if the measure passes, what's currently called the Department of Aging and Adult Services would become the Department of Disability and Aging Services. So not exactly a sea change there, but President Yee believes, and the reason he wanted to get this before voters is because he wants people to know that the services are there, that these agencies exist, and that they are for people who are, older citizens and people with disabilities, and he wants that just to be crystal clear to
people. It was also interesting to me that he has put forward in this measure a mandate that a commission that's set up would have to have someone 60 or older on it, someone with a disability on it, someone at least who's a veteran, and so forth. I mean, this is happening all over the corporate world. Now it's happening in terms of public.
Very true. It's a matter of representation in many respects. Again, that's the Disability and Aging Services Commission, which oversees that department that we were talking about. And, yeah, he wants to make sure that the people who are making those decisions are representative of the populace that they're trying to serve.
And again, Dominic Fricosa is staff writer with the San Francisco Chronicle. Marisa, you had something to add here?
Yeah, going back, I think, to Prop C and to the Lyft and Uber ballot measure, you know, I think if we step back a little bit and see what's happening with Juul nationally, obviously there's been this big vaping scandal. I think it's important to note that most of the people who have been sickened, it's not through legal products, whether they be cannabis or Juul, but I think it's really, we're seeing this bipartisan push on a national level to finally regulate these things, which is what this ballot measure says, is that, until the FDA steps in, we won't do it. Juul was spending a lot of money. I was getting a lot of mail. I think everybody else was too. And I think they saw the political writing on the wall and have stepped back. And I think it's indicative, and the Uber and Lyft sort of deal with Peskin, of the shifting tides around a lot of these gig economy tech companies who kind of came in guns blazing a decade ago, or over the last decade really, and have really upended so many parts of our society. And I think that you're seeing not just policymakers, but the public starting to push back a little bit. And I think that really speaks to the conversation we're seeing with presidential candidates like Elizabeth Warren calling on Facebook and other, these questions over monopolies. And I just think it's an interesting thing. We often see San Francisco leading the way on some of these questions. And so I think what happens what's already happened in some ways with these ballot measures really speaks to sort of where the conversation is going, not just in California, but nationally.
All right, let's go to San Francisco again, though, because I want to find out. Dominic mentioned the mayor's race, and how's that shaping up, Marisa?
No.
Is there a race?
I mean, there are a few other people on the ballot, but no, this is, Mayor Breed obviously just won the remainder of this term, and now we're seeing her having to be on the ballot again. I think, but for a pretty offensive ad that got put up by one of her opponents who's run several times.
It was ugly.
It was ugly, yeah. And racist. And I think that, that got some attention. But other than that, I think this mayor's race is really flying under the radar. And I think that in some ways it's a shame. I mean, she actually has some people challenging her. Our city treasurer, Jose Cisneros, does not. Paul Miyamoto is running for sheriff completely unopposed. Whatever you think of those candidates, they're all you know, long-serving public servants. I think that's a shame. It's not democratic to have these very powerful offices in a city and county, right? We often forget that San Francisco is unique in that way, to just sort of be anointed in that way. And so I think that, you know, I would say if, you know, people should be asking questions of their elected officials, regardless of whether or not they're being challenged on the ballot. And, you know, given what we're seeing on our streets and everywhere else, I think that there's some hard questions that a lot of these people need to be answering, whether or not they have somebody challenging them.
Well, it brings me to another possible anointment, at least the way somebody like Mr. Boudin might see it. Let me go to you on this, Dominic. I mean, this the polls are running pretty close between Chesa Boudin right now for DA and Susie Loftus, who was put into the position of district attorney by Mayor Breed. And I actually had an opportunity to interview them both on television, and he was very angry about that. And I asked him quite point blank, what if she had pointed you to that position? He said, I wouldn't have taken it. Civil ACLU is against it and so forth. How's this affecting the race?
I think it's galvanized opposition against Susie Loftus in some way. And I think that what, you know, Chess has said to you sort of encapsulates it. They feel as though the what was once the first uncontested district attorney's race, one without an incumbent, not uncontested, one without an incumbent, I should say, in over 100 years, suddenly we have an incumbent. We have somebody who is installed but for a couple of weeks. And it really tweaked people. I mean, they were upset about this. They felt that the mayor was putting her thumb on the scales. Now, the mayor says, look, I endorsed Susie Loftus over a year ago. I have every right to do this as the mayor. And, you know, by the law, she does. But I mean, wouldn't it have been just as easy to say, look, everyone knows I appointed Susie Loftus. Here is me making a non-political appointment or running, you know, George Gascon's chief of staff, letting her run
for
the office.
For three weeks.
It's not a long time. And I think it's starting to sink in with people. I think it could certainly galvanize more support for Chesa, who is running neck and neck for the you know, top poll position with Susie Loftus. Important to note, Leif Dotch, Nancy Tung also in this race as well. And of course, this is a ranked choice voting election as well, a ranked choice voting position. So whether or not that'll have any effect, we don't have candidates sort of teaming up. We haven't seen that yet, saying, you know, vote for me or vote for this other person, in order to knock off one of the leaders. But maybe that could have an effect when the polls start or when the ballots start to be counted.
What about Chesa's not having really any experience prosecuting? I mean, how does that play into it?
I'm going to be this person all hour. I'm like, let's step back and think about this nationally. But this is really sort of this race. I mean, there's two things to note. Chesa is a progressive candidate. He is an insurgent candidate. He is part of really something we're seeing across the nation in cities like Philadelphia and Chicago, where you have people who are not typical prosecutors or who have not been prosecutors in the case of, you know, Kim Fox in Chicago and others, who are running and getting a lot of support from national groups. The George Soros Foundation, for example, has funded a lot of these candidates. And, you know, a lot of what they're trying to do is really upend a system that has been stacked in many ways. And I think Dominic's point about this being the first open race in a century is the other thing I think is really important contextually to understand, which is that that's not a phenomenon unique to San Francisco. If you look around the state, what happens in most counties is a DA who run for these, they're not term limits for prosecutors. And so often a DA will announce that they are going to retire midterm. And in most cases, because, you know, again, we're a city and county, the Board of Supervisors and other places will anoint the next leader, who generally the retiring DA has sort of said, this is my person, and then they have incumbency. And so I think that the fact that this happened in a different way, very unusual way, of course, given that Gascon is leaving to go run in L.A., which is a whole other story we could talk about.
It's a saga.
Yeah,
it's an epic.
It really is. And the fact that, you know, all the candidates in the race, all four of them, are really running on this idea that, like, he has left a mess in this office, and they need to clean it up, and they all have different ideas. But, you know, I totally agree with Dominic. I don't know that this really matters. It's not going to change Susie's ballot designation. She won't be the incumbent on the ballot. But I think what it is doing is really giving fuel to a sense in the city of suspicion about the political class, about London Breed in particular. And I think there's some irony here, given the whole fight over London's, you know, assuming the mayoralship and then having it taken away from her, and the questions about her being, you know, a person of color and a woman. Like, there's just so much irony in this whole thing that now we're seeing this happen. And I got to say, I've known really most of these candidates for a long time. I'm a little surprised that Susie Loftus decided to take it as well. I think that, you know, you could see some of this backlash coming, and, you know, she did not have to.
Her response to that was, we needed somebody who had experience, and I was the one who was called for the job.
I've been called to serve. And, you know, and she is a lifelong public servant. I don't want to take that away from her. But I do think that this is giving some people pause who were probably going to vote for her.
Well, there's no dearth of irony, like you said, and certainly no dearth of lack of interest as far as politics in San Francisco are concerned or what's on the ballot. And this is an opportunity for you, our listeners, to not only get educated on that, but to exercise your franchise with a sense of enlightenment. And if you have questions or comments, I invite you to join us now. You can do that at our toll-free number. It's 866-733-6786. Please feel free to be part of the program. Again, join us at 866-733-6786. Or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. And I'm going to go back to you, Erica Aguilar, with a comment from a listener who tweets, San Francisco Chronicle information on Prop A mentions that, quote, it costs $700,000 per unit to build affordable housing in San Francisco. That's just a huge number, so I'm voting no on Prop A. I don't know what the solution to chronic poverty is, but building $700,000 apartments in San Francisco to house people isn't what I want to try.
That's the cost. I mean, we're talking about land costs. We're talking about labor costs. You're talking about the time. I mean, time is money, right? And if you're going through the approval process, and if you have a lengthy one, time is money, and it's going to cost that. This is just the way things are right now. And this is also why it's so hard to build affordable housing in the Bay Area, but also housing in general. And affordable housing is what we need right now, considering that people who are making $100,000 a year with a family of four can't not live here. And that's the story, again, that's sort of linked to the Proposition E when we're talking about educators who maybe teach kids here in San Francisco but commute from Pinole or something because they can't live here.
I don't think most of them can afford to live in Pinole either, actually.
Anymore.
Dominic, quick tweet from a listener on Prop C. I'm going to be voting no on Prop C. As an actual youth, I would not have been exposed to nicotine abuse if not for Juul. So I don't want any younger generations to have to deal with this absurd addiction the way I have, because I thought Juul looked cool in high school.
Yeah, that's what everybody thought. What's important to remember about Prop C that I don't think we've been explicit about yet is that it's basically this was a reaction to legislation that was passed and sort of spearheaded by Supervisor Shimon Walton and championed by City Attorney Dennis Herrera, which that said, look, we are going to, starting in 2020, we're going to put a moratorium on Juul because the FDA hasn't weighed in on the safety yet. So we're going to, starting in a couple of years, we're going to hit the pause button. And Juul, which is headquartered here, doesn't really want to be essentially frozen out of its own backyard, as it were, right? It's not a good look. I don't think San Francisco is Juul's biggest market, but not being able to do business here isn't a great look for that company. So they, again, poured a bunch of money in, ended up backing out as they sort of, you know, go through an existential review of their company, change CEOs, a lot of tumult at that company. But yeah, I mean, voting no says we don't want to overturn that ordinance that was passed. That's what that's important to note.
And again, Dominic Ficosa, is staff writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. You'd be part of this discussion. In fact, I know there's some strong opinions here. I'm looking at one from Lance who says, I will not be voting to reelect Mayor Breed. She has done nothing to streamline the building of affordable housing. Not true, but the streets are filthy, and I've seen no commitment to add significant staff to street cleaning, and nothing has changed with the homelessness crisis. Again, you may want to weigh in here, and indeed, if you have questions or comments, we welcome you to the program. You can give us a call right now at 866-733-6786. Number again, 866-733-6786, or get in touch with us on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email any questions or comments you might have to forum@kqed.org. Election 2019, a breakdown of San Francisco's November 5th ballot. More ahead. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking about Election 2019, breaking down San Francisco's November 5th ballot. And one of the things that we did want to talk about, which is not on the November ballot, is the mental health dueling ballot measures, which essentially have to do with addressing mental health problems in the city. There are actually two separate ballot measures, and It's been sort of judged that this is really all about politics. There's one that was put forward by Matt Haney and Hillary Ronan, and there's one that's been put forward by the mayor. They have different names. And we're talking, Marisa Lagos, about, the fact that they're talking now. I mean, for a while, it was pointed out that they should be in dialogue, and they weren't. But now we're moving forward, possibly?
Yeah. I mean, as someone who's watched City Hall for, 15 years now, I'm dating myself. I this actually does harken back in some ways to
start in elementary school.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Michael. This does harken back in some ways to me to the fights we saw when I first got here between Gavin Newsom, then mayor, and people like Chris Daley, supervisor, Aaron Peskin, although Aaron is a kind of a master of chess at these things. So sometimes he gets further than other soups. But there was these personality politics that the mayor and the supervisors just seemed unable to get past. And I really hope this is not history repeating itself, because what we've seen around juvenile justice between Lyndon Breed and Mayor Lyndon Breed and Supervisor Ronan and others, Supervisor Walton, we're seeing again with this mental health issue, which is sort of two separate camps in their, on the same floor of City Hall, trying to solve a problem that those of us who live in San Francisco don't care who gets credit for solving, just want to see solved. And so you have these two measures. At this point, they're both headed for the ballot. I think that, just speaking as a San Franciscan, I hope that there's something that they can really get together and sort out, because it does seem to me like this should go beyond politics. We're talking about people's mental health. And I think that, to right before the break, we heard from a listener who is unhappy with the mayor. I think, this is an area where, again, if you can fix it as mayor, no matter who wrote the initial ballot measure or policy, you're going to take the credit. And that's what's important to people. And I do think one thing to watch on this ballot, given what we talked about, which is that Lyndon Breed basically has no real challengers and that there are two other citywide offices with only one person on the ballot, is what's the undervote? We saw this with Ed Lee when there was a lot of sort of distrust of him. Where maybe, X amount of people come out and fill out ballots, but a lot of people just skip certain questions. And does that happen in the DA race because people are mad about Susie Loftus being appointed? Does it happen for Lyndon Breed because they're just unhappy with her so far? But that does tell you something. It's a little more squishy, but it is, I think, often indicative of where the voting public is. Because if you go to all the trouble to fill out a ballot, you are making a conscious choice to skip that kind of contest.
But the reality, let me go to you this, Dominic, is these aren't that far apart, although the mayor has expressed concern about overhauling the health department. That seems to be her major concern.
Yeah. I mean, the mayor herself says her plan is the overhaul that people should be excited about. So, I mean, I think just to take one small step back and say, why do we have two proposals here? Well, the fact, I think that it comes down to a question of, do you trust the health department as it exists right now? Supervisors Ronan and Haney have not been shy about the fact that they purposefully kept the top officials of the Department of Public Health in San Francisco at arm's length in crafting this measure. Now, those are the people who are going to be in charge of implementing whatever vision voters or anybody else ends up coming up with. So the mayor, on the other hand, said, look, I want my top officials. She's appointed the director of public health, Dr. Grant Colfax. She's appointed a director of mental health reform, Dr. Anton Negusa Bland, who was reviewing this whole thing and basically came up with what the mayor has proposed. He's the one who's been tasked with reviewing and writing it. So it's kind of like saying, look, mental health in San Francisco is in crisis levels right now. We've all seen people in deep distress and we don't know what to do about it. And the city needs to be stepping in and helping these people. OK, we can all agree on that. But it's a matter of, do we allow the department that sort of let things go astray? Do they have what it takes to take such broad corrective action? The supervisors don't believe it's true. And that's why they've came out with their proposal. So, no, you're right, though, Michael. The proposals are not vastly different, certainly not to the average voters. There are some differences around who would be treated. The mayor wants to focus on the roughly 4,000 people who have sort of this deadly trifecta of homelessness, psychosis, and substance abuse. She says that's the population that we need to target. The supervisor's proposals has narrowed over time, but they have a bigger universe of potential patients in mind. Some people who have Medi-Cal, for example, or who on Healthy SF, the city's insurance plan. So there are nuances like that. And I also think it's important to point out that I think by by when we get to March and when we get to next November, I don't think we're going to see two ballot measures. There is still a lot of time for compromise. We know now that at long last, the two sort of factions here are talking to each other. And maybe if we wanted to put rosy lenses on, we could say, I guess it's good that people are fighting about who has the better massive overhaul of the city's mental health and behavioral health care systems. I guess if we wanted to kind of put a positive spin on it. But I think there is still time. We have until November 27th for these ballot measures to be pulled off. So we're going to fix this. We're going to do it legislatively, and it'll be a lot cleaner and cheaper.
I think they've been somewhat embarrassed publicly by this as well. Paul Lynn, for example, who was on the forum program, psychiatrist at SF General, says, can't they just talk to each other? Can't they just get along?
Right. And it's like, worst case, we end up with another Prop C, which, if folks remember, was a tax law to help the city's wealthiest companies fund homeless services. And the mayor had been left out of that discussion and was unhappy with it. And so she ended up not opposing it per se. But, you know, now there's been questions over the fact that it didn't get a 2/3 vote, whether the city can actually implement it. And again, like, I just think we have to keep in mind that your average person who lives and works in San Francisco is not interested in the personality differences of the people elected at City Hall. They want to see changes. And I think that the worst case, to Dominic's point, And hopefully we won't see this, but is two competing measures, because that just confuses people. And when people are confused, they vote no.
You'd like to send it to the legislature, really, wouldn't they?
That would be, you know, right. What we elected
Erica,
them
you
to
want
do.
To weigh in here? Erica Aguilar?
I would just say that sending the Prop C measure last year, you know, failed. Some might argue that maybe it was an uncomfortable thing to ask for redistribution of wealth in funding housing. Maybe that might be the thing. Who knows? Thinking about Prop A now, again, with the proposition $600 million bond, what you're asking is for everybody to contribute on that one. And with the city being able to get Prop A out without raising taxes, you know, that could also make it a little easier for voters to swallow.
We got a lot of callers. Let's get to as many of you as we can. And we begin with Rick from Oakland. Rick, you're on the air.
Yes, I just wanted to say something about the DA contest. You know, San Francisco's a liberal city, yet we have a police department that has been caught out in racist tweets and resisting accountability. Now, they just recently put up $50,000 against Chesa Boudin. So to me, it means that they're kind of intervening in the democratic process to try to stop someone who was going to clean up the police department and the DA's office. He was a public defender for 9 years, so he does know the system.
Yeah.
Okay. We'll let that comment stand. Marisa, you want to respond now?
Well, I just want to say, I mean, the POA in this town is super controversial and, by San Francisco standards, incredibly conservative. And it was pretty, and they have not always gotten along with Susie Loftus. I think that's important to note. She was head of the police
commission.
She's
on the commission, yeah.
She pushed tasing rules and use of force rules that the police union was not happy with. And when Mayor London Breed appointed Susie Loftus, they sent out this sort of non-endorsement where they basically were like, thank God it's not Chesa. which, I think in given everything we're talking about, like, that probably shouldn't be the ding on Susie Loftus. She clearly is not in lockstep with the POA, if you think that's a bad thing. But I think that they did. I mean, I know the deputy sheriff's endorsed Lee Douch. Mm-hmm. I don't know if the POA actually endorsed anyone.
That's a good question. I don't know. I don't know either. To your point, though, there are no shortage of people who say, what is the POA doing? I'm going to vote the opposite of that. I mean, so that there's certain that the caller is not alone in that sentiment.
And there are two other candidates in this race, lest we forget. And they are both certainly credible and important figures in terms of their views of law enforcement and judicious use of the justice system. Let me get another caller on her. Sarah, that's you. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. Hi, Marisa. This is Sarah, Max and Nina's mom from Little Bear. I was actually calling to just bring up the school board race. I'm a parent of two kids in the public school system here in San Francisco. We started out at one of the traditional public schools, and I was pretty disappointed that my son didn't receive services despite repeated requests. His end of the report card after the first year was basically, we recognize he has needs which are impacting his learning, but we were not able to give him services. So as a result, I pulled him out of that school and I put him in one of our local charter schools. And he's done so much better. The school has it has an inclusion teaching model, so it includes students with disabilities into standard classes rather than separating them out. It's achieving really good test scores. And recently, the entire school board voted against reauthorization of charter schools, this one in particular. And at the meeting, I was there at the meeting and pretty upset by the school board member participants who were on their cell phones during the meeting when parents were giving their testimonies of their experience at the school. So there is one candidate who's an incumbent for re-election for the school board, and I would just suggest that we do not support her re-election and go for either of the other two candidates. I'm sorry, all their names are escaping me right now, but the other two candidates are focused more on closing achievement gaps between the students of color.
Sarah, I'm glad you put your view here forward, and I thank you for that call. We were actually not covering the school board election, though. Anyone comment on it, Marisa Lagos?
Yeah, I mean, there are three candidates. I think I would just say broadly, Jenny Lamb is who she's referring to. She's on the school board. Robert Coleman and Kirsten Strobel are the other two candidates. I think that, you know, school board, judgeships, the city college trustees, these are places where it can be really hard to sort of decide as a voter to get a really good read on these candidates. I mean, there are a lot of resources out there, and I think that, you know, looking at their websites and sort of looking at their priorities is probably the best way to make these decisions, because unfortunately, we don't always have the time to cover each of these races in as much depth as I think the community deserves.
And I want to read a comment from John. It's apropos of what I just said a few moments ago. He writes, your program today seems to anoint Boudin and Loftus for district attorneys citing polls. It's too bad that you ignore Nancy Tung and Leif Dauch. Citing polls the way you do unduly influences the election. Well, how much weight do polls really, I mean, that big question that looms over just about every race that we think of from the national down to the local here. The poll did come out and say those two were in the lead, but, you know, some...
Right.
Entirely to rely on polls, we would have to think twice about the last presidential election,
yes.
And maybe 100 times more.
Yeah, no, I think I think the listener's point is well taken, and we should mention the fact that, you know, Leif Dauch, you know, works in the Attorney General's office, is an experienced prosecutor himself. Nancy Tung, a former prosecutor in the San Francisco District Attorney's office, now in the Alameda County office, both experienced, professional, totally competent people, and worthy of people's, you know, you should look them up. You should look them all up. So the question about polls, you should always ask in polls, how is this written? What's the sample size? People really should do their homework, and that's what we try to do as reporters, is try to understand how these polls come to be. But it's not just about the polling. It's about sort of being able to take the temperature and watching these races closely and trying to understand who is emerging as a leader and why.
And let me mention, and this is not necessarily trying to further the forum program, but we did an interview with all four candidates. It's in the archives. If you want to learn more about those candidates and where they stand, I urge you to do that, but I agree completely with Dominic. They are all actually four in many different ways impressive candidates and all professionals. Let me go to another caller. Tracy, that's you. Good morning.
Tracy, San Francisco here. I'm confused about the statement that Prop A does not raise taxes. I've been to several neighborhood meetings, including apartment association meetings, and there is too much misinformation regarding tax implication for Prop A. The voter pamphlet booklet describes the tax implication as $100 per $600,000 assessed property. Just because there is a previous passed proposition on affordable housing that is retiring, it doesn't mean that this does not raise new taxes. It's not any consolation here for no new taxes. There is a tax on Prop A. Also, the answer that time is money regarding the construction cost per unit of affordable housing built is not really an answer here. There's $800,000 to build a unit in San Francisco is a lot of money. I think the money is being allocated to other resources, and including government, you know, government resources as well. So I think that this proposition, I won't be voting yes, I'm Prop A for affordable housing.
Appreciate your position and joining us, Tracy. Let me go to Erica Aguilar on this. Erica?
Right. So it's $700,000 that's estimated per unit for affordable housing. When you think about how much it costs to buy a home here and compare that to building affordable housing, you know, they're not, well, one, they're far apart, right? So you're thinking about the median home right now in San Francisco, which is around $1.5 million to about $700,000 to build affordable housing. Housing is just expensive. That's
just the way
it is. I mean,
it's expensive for private developers to build market rate housing, too.
Exactly.
We should say that this isn't unique to San Francisco government. This money isn't being, like, siphoned off.
Right. And then, and also, you know, when you're building affordable housing, it's a piecemeal process. It's a little bit of a quilt because you're getting money from the city. You're also getting money from the state, low-income tax credits. You're getting money from developers would call hard debt, which is just your traditional loans from a bank. Hopefully it's not huge. So it's just it just costs a lot of money. And then to the property taxes question, she's right. Yes, it does raise property taxes. But again, because of the retirement of the elder bonds, the way they shift around, it doesn't shift it so much.
But there's been a kind of pattern of San Francisco voters being in favor of affordable housing. Almost anything that's on the ballot with affordable housing.
Yeah, and I think it's important to note that San Francisco actually has a pretty robust sort of approach to the way it approaches bond debt. So I would say, unlike the state of California, where we've seen huge fluctuations and not a lot of planning around how to sort of prioritize bonds, because you have 120 members of the legislature with different ideas. In San Francisco, there's actually this capital committee that comes forward to the board and the mayor and says, hey, like, we don't want property taxes to go much higher. So as old debts get retired, what should we prioritize for the next bonds that we're going to ask voters to approve? Now, it's perfectly legitimate as this caller, you know, to oppose that and to want your property taxes to go down and to say, fine, I have my house and we shouldn't build any affordable housing. But I think it is important to know that this is actually an area where San Francisco has been almost conservative in the way it approaches, like, how they prioritize bond debt. And it's one of the rare areas, given all the disagreements we've talked about, where you generally see the board and the mayor coming together and supporting the plan, again, to ask voters to approve it.
Yeah. And Proposition A didn't have a lot of contention at City Hall when it was being made. You know, it was mostly an agreement. And to look back at the history of affordable housing bonds in San Francisco. So we had the 2015 one that voters approved. That was a $310 million housing bond measure, and that was sponsored by Mayor Ed Lee, you know, to build and rehab 30,000 units of affordable housing over his would have been 4-year term or so. Well, so that was the 2015 one. But before that, you know, there was also, or 2016, there was another affordable housing bond. However, that was part of another bond that allowed the redistribution of remaining bond money, $260 million, that was actually originally voted to upgrade these buildings for earthquake safety. And they had remaining bond money. And so we went back to the voters in 2016 to say, hey, could we use this to upgrade affordable housing units for earthquakes. So besides that, when we think about other bonds, the last really successful city housing bond measure before this proposal, before 2015, before 2016, was in 1996 for an amount of $100 million. And when we think about how much affordable housing we need to build in San Francisco or in the Bay Area and California in general, $100 million, $600 million, $310 million.
I'll use Dominic's phrasing here, chump change.
Yes.
But, you know, we're talking about actually building or preserving nearly 1,400 units with the 2015 bond, and now you've got twice that many at least in the mix in Proposition A. They're estimating 2,800, aren't they?
Yeah, that's right. And just one point of clarity: $700,000 is the total development cost of one unit of affordable housing, and of course that's outrageously
and market rate,
high.
I believe.
That
yes.
could very well
yeah,
be.
Yeah,
right.
I was
yeah,
looking it up.
Yeah, that's what it is.
The city kicks in, and Michael, you said the number before about 250 to 300,000 per unit. So I just want to make that clear. Like that's the city's contribution, and that's what this bond money would look to fund. And to your point previously, Michael, about why these things tend to be popular, why voters like them, I mean, think about what the city is issuing bonds for. Recently, to repair a crumbling seawall that protects about, what, $100 billion in infrastructure? You know, we're talking about affordable housing at a time when we're, you know, at a crisis, people cannot afford to come to this city and to live in this city, and people are on the brink of homelessness because of that. Earthquake safety and preparedness. I mean, parks. These are the things that the city sells bond debt for. And now if you think, like, well, again, I don't want the city to go into debt, even though it's sort of planned for it and has a way to repay it without drastically raising property taxes, that's that's going to be people's prerogatives. But
there's not a lot of just regular money coming in for housing in general. You know, when we are thinking about the redevelopment agencies, and now that's not here anymore. So we're thinking about where is constant money coming from, and there are not very many sources. So I'll say over, you know, just watching elections, the housing bond, not just in San Francisco, but in California and throughout the country, has become the place where we go to fund this affordable housing, which can't be done in the market.
Yeah, there's just been a complete retreat by the federal government and state authorities. This money's not coming. We're going to have to get it ourselves.
And by the way, if you would like to join us in the time remaining, the toll-free number to call is 866-733-6786. And here's a listener who wants to know if any of you have any comments on the District 5 supervisorial race between Dean Preston and Valley Brown.
Just to say that I think it's sort of an interesting matchup in the sense, you know, Valley Brown was a longtime aide of Ross Marcarimi, who was a sort of darling of the progressive left. She has been seen, I mean, she was appointed by London Breed,
yep,
right?
Yes, indeed. Who she was also a legislative aide for.
Who she was also a legislative aide for, knows that district very well. Dean Preston has run for the seat before. He's definitely running on her left. Of course, this is all like very left of center because we're talking San Francisco. I think Dominic might jump in, but I think it really has shaped up to be a sort of typical San Francisco progressive versus liberal race in some ways.
Yeah, I think that's fairly true. This is the only contested seat. Valley Brown now running for a full term following her appointment by the mayor after the mayor left that seat to go be mayor. So, yeah, it's been not a terribly... I don't know. It's not been an arresting race, I suppose. You've got sort of Valley Brown, who has to be very careful to come out as independent, but not, you know, buck the mayor who appointed her into that seat in the first place. And she has quietly, legislatively, if you look at her voting record, there have been instances on small things, not usually very big things, where she has gone against the mayor. They can't really get. I think the sort of the notion that Valley Brown is in the pocket of the mayor is something that people should interrogate very closely. And I don't think that reflects reality. Dean Preston lost to London Breed the last time around by 1%. It's a progressive district. It has been in the past. We'll see if he can pull it out this time.
You know, Marisa mentioned Chris Daley a bit ago, and those kind of divisions not only still exist, they're not even vestigial, but some would say they're exacerbated. They're worse than ever. The dichotomy between the farther left and
the personalities have changed because term limits have pushed some folks out. But, you know, we're seeing, say, in District 11, right? That's the Excelsior.
Yes.
John Avalos weighing a possible challenge of Asha Safai. So I think, you know, some of the personalities are actually coming back and looping around. It's San Francisco. This is San Francisco politics. I think that some years are better than others in terms of everybody's ability to get along. But it's not a new story here.
And I think to your point previously, Marisa, the notion, again, just to sort of zoom out to the national level here, why are they coming back around again? It's because the ideas that they were sort of espousing in San Francisco and was, you know, easily sort of shelved as like, oh, that's a crazy San Francisco liberal idea. Many of those ideas are now mainstream, whether it's, you know, Bernie Sanders or Elizabeth Warren. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, those ideas now are very much in vogue and people are identifying with them, and you have that sort of steam nationally. You know, focus back down to San Francisco, you've got people like Dean Preston who's running as a democratic socialist. I mean, that sort of a wind, I think, has sort of caught the sails here of local races.
And we'll catch another caller. We'll go next to a listener named Starchild. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Michael. Marisa Lagos made a good point about the undemocratic nature of so many incumbents having no opponents, but I'd like to point out that a major cause of this is the media don't cover all candidates equally. They pay more attention to incumbents, and so either other people are deterred from running in the first place, or the voters don't think other candidates have a chance to win, like in the mayor's race, and then everybody expects the mayor's going to get reelected. I think outlets, especially like NPR, should give equal time to all candidates on the ballot. And voters, meanwhile, can fight back by when you're in doubt, you know, vote no. And when in doubt, vote against the incumbent. If they don't have any opponent, write somebody in. But I do urge people to vote for Chase Boudin for DA, who's really criminal justice reform oriented.
Well, credit to Michael here. He had all four candidates on the show. And I know that it takes a little bit of work for voters. And I think this is a well-pointed well taken point for us reporters here. I'd also say that the DA candidates have done dozens of forums around town. I moderated two of them. Again, they're all serious candidates. And I do think that that is one important thing to step back and acknowledge, is that we are lucky in that race to have an embarrassment of riches, really. Wherever you come down sort of politically, I think that they're all very smart, qualified people who really care about San Francisco. And so, unlike some of the other races we pointed out, at least we have a choice in this one.
Well, it used to be a little bit of a historical footnote here that when we had a lot of third-party candidates running back in the day, and I felt it incumbent upon us to at least give them the platform and give them an opportunity to state what their views were. And in many cases, it was very enlightening to hear what their views were. But then you run into the problem, as you do in races of all kinds. You have too many candidates. And especially when you have races that are zealously pursued, you have too many candidates. So where do you draw the line? Unfortunately, you have to go to the numbers. And you go to the numbers, you're going to the polls often. And you're going to the support.
Or this fundraising.
Fundraising money. Yeah. And yeah. So it boils down to often polls and money. It's aggravating.
The caller's point is very well taken. We in the media have to be very careful that we don't sort of get into the vicious cycle of saying, oh, that person doesn't have a chance, and then therefore they have no chance and get
right.
No media attention. I mean, that's a very dangerous thing. But I do think that perhaps give us a little bit of credit, and I'm biased here, but we look at people who have campaign organizational structure, who are putting out their politics and their vision and actually campaigning. That doesn't always happen. Just because we have five candidates for mayor doesn't mean people are pounding the pavement every day. And it's not just about fundraising. It's about it's also not about anointing somebody's viability, but it's about taking a step back and actually take as an objectively as you can and say, is this person a serious candidate?
Yeah, I mean, I was out this weekend at Sunday Streets in the Excelsior, and Chesa, for example, had a really big presence there. He was there actually, and you saw a couple other signs, but I do think that a lot of the excitement, if you're just around San Francisco, and I know everyone in this, all of us live here, so we're not just coming in for the day, is that Susie and Chesa have seemed to generate the most interest and excitement along the
Full disclosure, I don't live in San Francisco, but I've got another caller on. I want to go to you, Patty. Go ahead, you're on the air.
In talking about the housing bond, the one thing that has not come up is water. We're looking at water rationing, and I wonder how many more units we can build.
Yeah, boy, we need a whole hour to examine that properly. Can you give us a quick scope here, Erica Aguilar?
I think that's actually a very good point when we're talking about density, because you're asking, especially when we think not just about the housing bond, but if we think about the accessory dwelling units and we're adding new units to houses.
Water becomes central.
Yeah, what are we going to do with our infrastructure? Yeah.
We have to leave it on that note. We'll be, of course, taking that up, no doubt, in a later program. But let me thank the trio that were here with us this whole hour. Erica Aguilar is a reporter for KQED News. Thank you, Erica. And thank you, Dominic. Dominic Fracassa is a staff writer for the San Francisco Chronicle. Good to have you.
Pleasure.
And thank you, Marisa Lagos, politics correspondent with KQED and co-host of KQED's Political Breakdown Show.
My pleasure, Michael.
And thank you, our listeners. We wouldn't be here without you, and we are indeed in debt that you are here with us and grateful. For all of us at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.